Welcome to The Mental Breakdown, where we tackle all issues related to mental health, mental illness, parenting, schooling, relationships, and everything in between. While Drs. Bernie and Richard will provide the most up-to-date ideas and perspectives, the information provided in this podcast is not a substitute for medical care. Our goal here at The Mental Breakdown is to provide you with information to help you make your life the best it can be. So without further ado, here's Dr. Bernie and Dr. Richard. Welcome to episode 27 of The Mental Breakdown. This is Dr. Bernie.
This is Dr. Richard.
And Richard, this week was supposed to be a week of celebration for, or at least awareness for us in the mental health field.
Right.
Wow. There we go. We got a little feedback there. Nothing like trying to figure out the fun stuff with live radio. We're sitting in our little room trying to figure all this out and was getting a little bit of feedback there. So hopefully it sounds okay now. But yes, this past week was Mental Illness Awareness Week.
Right.
And it kind of came and went without much of a...
Not much fanfare. We were... almost unaware of it because it wasn't advertised, wasn't discussed. I mean, you have other disorders, but this is one of the points we want to make,
right?
Is that here you have Mental Illness Awareness Week, and there's virtually no information disseminated about it, which brings us to one of the points we're going to be making this morning.
Right, right. Yeah, it's so funny because on Facebook you get these things about, hey, it's National Pancake Day.
Right.
But
right.
There's nothing about Mental Illness Awareness Week, and it's something that it is absolutely critical that we're talking about. And so what we decided to do in respect of Mental Illness Awareness Week, we're going to spend this podcast talking about our view of mental illness and sort of we called it a call of action, right? We need a call of action.
Right.
We need to start paying attention to this a little bit more because, for goodness sakes, this is kind of getting out of hand. We're going to venture into the world of politics a little bit, but we're going to be careful.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there is just so much disparity in the way that we manage mental illness and mental health as it relates to, you know, as compared to physical health and other forms of medicine. And we need to remedy that.
Mm-hmm.
We need to address that.
We do. And the director of the National Institutes of Mental Health resigned this week. He's changing jobs. And he was interviewed earlier in the week and said, not only do we need a wake-up call, he said, we need a siren blaring to bring attention to the problems of mental illness. He and others in the know are calling for significant changes in information about mental illness, how we deal with people with mental illness, as well as the caregivers of persons with mental illness. So it is a huge topic, and it's an important topic.
Absolutely.
I'm glad we're doing this morning.
Yeah, I think it's going to, hopefully it's going to be great. Hopefully we'll get some people to, hopefully there are people listening that will be able to write into us. Remember, again, I guess the only way that you would be able to hear this right now is if you're on Mixlr already, but spread the word to try to get more people to listen on Mixlr, because it's a great way for us to be able to chat while we're talking, and especially with a topic like this. This is something that I think is a nice topic for us to have a discussion about, and while Richard, you and I can sit here and we could talk about this for days.
We could be here until Monday morning.
It would be nice to hear from others who have some other ideas and thoughts and concerns and issues. So
now, it is an issue. It is an important issue because this issue of mental illness, I'm convinced now, touches every family in the country.
Absolutely.
I mean, one way or another, I think every person, every family in the United States is touched in some way by mental illness.
Well, I think the statistics are basic.
Right.
You know, all of the estimates that we have are that at least 20% of us, that's one in five.
20% of Americans.
Of Americans experience some mental illness at some point in our life.
Right.
So what that means is if you have the typical family of four, well, four and a half.
Four or five, right.
Mm-hmm. Somebody in that family, mm-hmm. based upon statistics, right. is likely to experience some form of mental illness. And so right. if you expand it, to your extended family, the likelihood of you being touched in some way mm-hmm. by mental illness is pretty likely. It's pretty high.
And mental illness is one of those things that doesn't know any boundaries for financial status, your socioeconomic status, your ethnic status, your health status in general. It affects right. everybody.
Everybody.
It's indiscriminate.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so our approach today to talk about this is, you know, we're going to start out a little bit more about why it's important that we're talking about this. I think that Mental Illness Awareness Week came at a opportune time for a discussion because of the shootings within the past couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to go into talking about some of the areas that we think are the most important areas that we really need to focus in on, because either these are issues that are over politicized, and we just need some, I hate to use this word because this is what all the pundits say, we need some common sense okay. brought to it. And because these are areas that, again, as you said, sort of touch all of us, and, right. and we need to talk about these issues. And right. so,
and you make another good point, that is that the shootings make the news.
Right.
So they become popular in the sense of everybody knows about the shootings as those might relate to mental illness. Okay.
Right.
But the effects of mental illness are felt in virtually all institutions and in all areas. It's felt in schools, and yet you never hear about the effects of mental illness in schools.
Right.
But yet it's there every day. Teachers know about it.
Right.
Administrators know about it. But it's not in the news. So while there's a lot of emphasis on shooters and mental illness, there are many other issues that we should be discussing that are not being discussed. So I'm hoping that this morning we're able to bring some of these other issues to the fore.
Absolutely. We're gonna talk about all of those and a couple of others. So again, as we've already said, you know, the unfortunate circumstances that we're here once again talking about a mass shooting.
Yet another shooting.
And, you know, it is fortunate, yes, yet unfortunate that these kinds of situations turn into political right. discussions right. And arguments. When I think that, you know, when you really get down to the brass tacks of it, everyone wants us to be safe. People on the left side of the row and people on the right side of the row, everybody wants us to be safe and wants us to be secure and feel comfortable and feel confident in what we are, our freedoms and all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, I think if we really sat down and talked about it, which I have over the past couple days, I've talked to several of my friends who have very strong feelings about how guns right. Mm-hmm. Are gun rights and everything.
Right.
You know, when we sit down and actually talk about it, I think everybody can be very reasonable about this. Mm-hmm. It's just that when we turn it into a politicized issue,
right. Right.
we get polarized to right. the extremes.
Right.
And we need to have a more coherent discussion about this.
Yeah, we really do need to have a discussion about guns and mental illness and schools, but it has to be a rational discussion. Let's calmly discuss all these things, because the implications are important. They're vitally important, in fact, because people are losing their lives. Not only are people losing their lives in shootings, but families are being torn apart by mental illness.
Right.
And there's no reason that this should be happening in this century.
Right.
In the wealthiest country in the world. And there's absolutely no reason why mental illness should be doing to our country what it is doing to our country.
Right, mm-hmm. right. And so what Mental Illness Awareness Week should have done, what should have happened this right. week, is we should have had people at podiums and in front of large crowds talking about mm-hmm. the critical nature of right. mental illness and why we need to be pouring attention and resources into this significant issue.
Right.
You know, we talk about cancer and we talk about heart disease and we talk about all these other things, mental illness, the prevalency of mental illness is approaching the significance and prevalence of those medical issues that
right.
you know mm-hmm. have some that get so much attention. So we need to we need to be considering that. So that's why we're going to talk about that today. We feel that it's imperative that this discussion happens, and we hope that you know this discussion that we're having today is going to turn some other people on to talking about it and mm-hmm. wanting to spread their voice about what they feel is important with mental illness.
Right. I was reading a medical journal not long ago, and I was struck by a short one-page article that said, "I wish my son had cancer." That stopped me in my tracks.
Sure
and I said,
did.
What is this about? And what the article was about was written by a physician whose son, teenage son, has a diagnosis of bipolar disorder. Mm. And he said, as sad as it is, if his son had a disease like cancer, there would be awareness weeks, there would be money, there would be children's hospitals, there would be football players visiting him, athletes visiting him, and there would be sympathy and support for him and his family. The fact that his child had bipolar disorder, it was just the opposite. In fact, they were shunned
right.
by family and friends. So when we say, people talk about the stigma about mental illness, there shouldn't be, there is a stigma.
Right.
And one of the reasons that there's a stigma is because of the lack of, I don't want to say ignorance, but I want to say the lack of knowledge and the lack of awareness of this disorder. But it, we sure are reaching a state of an emergency when somebody says, "I wish my child had a physical disease rather than a mental disease."
Absolutely. And that is obviously exactly where we need to begin this discussion. And that is with the stigma. We wrote in the newspaper column this week for the Ledger that kind of went back to a couple of years ago. I wrote a column and I mentioned that there is a stigma
right.
to mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
And I received this nasty email from a person who read it. Actually, what I think he did was I think he had one of those scanners on some program where he was looking for different blogs and different mm-hmm. articles and stuff that, and he was really just targeting the word stigma.
Words, right.
And so he was trying to pick those out, and he saw it. So I don't know that he was a regular listener, but reader, but he said, you know, you're exactly what's wrong with mental health. You're, you know, this is.
He was blaming you for creating the stigma?
He was blaming me for perpetuating,
perpetuating.
The idea that there's a stigma. And I, you know, that has stuck with me for years because right. It just blows my mind mm-hmm. that, you know, we feel like we can just say, okay, there's not a stigma, and then the stigma will go
and it'll
away.
It'll go away, right.
Mm-hmm. You know, it remains that. And we have seen this over the past decade. Mm-hmm. There are disease du jours,
right?
It became okay for a while to have a kid with ADHD.
Right.
It's becoming not okay, but less of a stigma to have a child with autism because there's right. so much awareness.
There's autism awareness.
And I think that that's what makes the difference. What makes the difference is that we have people out there talking about autism. We have characters in TV shows that have autism spectrum disorders. We have characters on programs talking about ADHD and talking about some of these things. And when we get that information out there, when we have people talking about it, like this is a real part of life, the stigma begins to diminish.
Right. Right.
But that has not happened for schizophrenia. That right. has not happened for bipolar disorder or depression or anxiety. Right. Instead, we look at people with those kinds of issues and we see them as broken or mm-hmm. we see them as people who, you know, they stay away from everyone else
they
and they seclude themselves.
They somehow present a threat to
us. Or they present as a threat.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And we have to recognize that this stigma is contributing to the problem.
Right.
There was a study in NIH. They talk about thinking about the dangerousness of people mm-hmm. with mental illness, if a person with mental illness is receiving treatment, they are 15 times less likely to become violent.
That's right. 15, 1-5.
15
times double-digit number.
Less likely
right.
to be violent.
Right.
Yet...
If they're getting treatment.
If they're getting treatment. Yet we know that a significant portion of people with mental illness are not receiving treatment.
In school-age children, it's 80%. 80% of school-age children with a mental illness never get a diagnosis and never get treatment.
Right. Mm-hmm. And we have to believe that those numbers are similar in adulthood.
I'm convinced that they are, right.
Because if you're not receiving treatment in childhood, why would you seek treatment as an adult?
Mm-hmm.
So the stigma perpetuates the problem.
Right.
And yet this person who wrote into me claims that, well, just stating that there's a stigma perpetuates the idea that there's a stigma and that's the problem.
Right.
And instead, my view and the way that I responded to that gentleman was, I disagree. What we have to do is we have to acknowledge that it's a stigma.
There is, yes.
And attack it head on.
Right. And the other reason we know there's a stigma is there's a stigma in financial reimbursement. The fact that for physical illnesses, you have insurance that will pay for it. Mental illness, many insurance companies won't even reimburse
right.
for treatment for mental illness. And so, just strictly from an economic or financial standpoint, there is a difference in reimbursements for mental illness versus physical illness.
Right.
So there is a stigma. And instead of denying that there's a stigma or saying we're perpetuating it, because having a stigma is part of the problem. So let's get rid of the stigma as soon as we can and get on to the issues.
Absolutely. And that takes me back to when I was working in the Department of Psychiatry early in my career, back in the late 90s. And I was working with Dr. Archie Silver,
right.
Who was a mentor. He was an amazing man. You knew him.
Right.
He was in his 80s at the time when I was working with him. And
he was still writing books in his 80s.
He was a beast.
He was a beast. He's an inspiration to all of us.
But I remember, working with him and trying to learn from him. And I recall him giving a diagnosis to this kid. And the kid was suffering from Tourette's disorder. And the kid, he had a comorbid disorder. He had a co-occurring disorder of ADHD. And Dr. Silver filled out the paperwork for the insurance and put that he had Tourette's disorder. A couple of weeks later, we get a note back from the insurance company that says, we don't reimburse for Tourette's disorder treatment. And I'm thinking, I remember in my perhaps naive mind at the time.
Naivete, right.
Here we have Dr. Silver, who has been practicing medicine since the 1940s.
World-renowned child psychiatrist. Known all over the world. Literally,
right.
Really is. World-famous child psychiatrist.
And he's giving a diagnosis to this kid, and the insurance company is saying, no, we won't. We won't pay for that treatment.
Mm-hmm.
So he had to change the primary... If he wanted to receive payment, he would have had to change the diagnosis of the child from primary diagnosis of Tourette's disorder, which was his primary diagnosis, to ADHD,
mm-hmm.
Because they would pay for that by a psychiatrist.
Right.
If he was a psychologist, they wouldn't have paid for the ADHD treatment.
Right.
So, the idea or the fact that there's a stigma is blatant.
Right.
There is no masking this. We're not. Nobody is pretending like we're treating everything fair and equal and of equal importance.
Mm-hmm.
The disparity is massive.
Right.
And what that leads to is a lack of treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And you know the history better than I do, Richard. A lot of the treatment facilities for mental illness began to disappear in the 1960s with President Kennedy. And he was talking about closing down a lot of the mental illness hospitals and a lot of those kinds of things. And, it took some time for that to catch up and that to get where it needed to be. But what eventually happened, and I think that it all started with good intentions.
Well, it did with Kennedy because, of course, his famous one of his sisters had a prefrontal lobotomy,
right?
And spent time in one of these institutions, and the Kennedy family was appalled at the level of treatment in mental hospitals as they existed at the time,
right?
So, yeah, that began the reformation of mental health facilities. The problem really was addressed. The problem wasn't addressed in the 1980s in the Reagan administration.
Right.
The mental institutions were shut down. Instead of reforming them,
right,
the Reagan administration has shut them down. And so that put all of these, again, good intentions. I think the intention was that we would take care of them in our communities, in homes,
right,
in group homes. So I think the intention was good, but the unintended consequences is that people with mental illness were now living on the street rather than in institutions.
Right. And what that has, how that has evolved over the subsequent, 30 years or so,
right,
is that now we have very few hospital beds for mental illness.
Exactly.
We have very few community-based treatment,
right,
quality community-based treatment facilities.
That's right.
And, people just can't, for many of the financial and economic,
right,
reasons we were talking about a minute ago, people just can't get the treatment that they need.
Right.
There was a, when it comes to some of this stuff, there was a study in 2005 in New York. And what they found is that when they opened up and began having outpatient treatment facilities that were community-based, that allowed people who yeah, had criminal histories and people who had lots of difficulties to gain access, the study found that it reduced the rates of imprisonment, homelessness, right, substance abuse, and emergency room treatment for mentally ill patients by up to 70%.
Right.
So when we have the treatment facilities available, the impact, not just on the patient, him or herself, but on society, decreases dramatically, up to 70%.
That's right. Everybody benefits.
When you think about the resources and all the emergency rooms, are now, they all have billboards all over the place about how long the wait time would
be. Yeah.
I always think about how many of those people, how much of that time is extended because that's how mentally ill people are receiving treatment now. They have to go through emergency departments, and so they clog up that system,
right,
where that we should have other systems in place for them to be able to get the treatment that they need.
That's right. Yeah. Well, and I might add, they either go through the emergency room or they go through the police department.
Right.
They commit a crime, or they're accused of committing a crime, and they go through the police department and they end up getting mental health services through the legal system.
Right.
Which is also backwards, but
right,
another topic that we'll be discussing.
Right. And the last part of this was that, that was a study in New York. Duke University did another study, and they looked at some of the same stuff and found that, and this, I think, hits home as we kind of shift into what is a little bit more politicized, is the idea that those community-based treatment facilities reduce Medicaid costs by up to over 40%.
Right.
For
right,
people with mental illness. So again, we're talking about resources that are being used in ways that are I don't want to say wasteful, but they're being spent in ways that we could certainly spend those dollars in a smarter, better way.
Exactly. And all of us have heard all the financial arguments about we can't use emergency rooms as primary care facilities. We've all heard those arguments, is that there are people who don't have insurance and don't have a primary care physician, and when their children get an ear infection, they go to the emergency room.
Right.
Well, an ear infection should be about a $50 doctor visit.
Right.
If you go to an emergency room, it's 10 times that. It's a $500 to $1,000 cost just to treat an ear infection. And we're facing the same kind of disparity and the same kind of financial problem in the mental health, is the mental illness arena, is that there are ways, sensible ways of managing individuals with mental illness that would be a fraction of the cost of running them through an emergency room or a jail.
Right.
You know, there are just if you look at it from a financial standpoint, not from a what's best for the person standpoint, just from a financial standpoint, we could save millions, hundreds of millions of dollars.
Right. Mm-hmm. It would make it would address many of the issues
right.
that we have mm-hmm. not only in the healthcare system but in our finances and
right. Save enormous amounts of money.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So let's with that, let's kind of shift into the more contentious topic of guns. Now, this is always a tough topic, and you know, those of you who have listened to all previous 26 podcasts that we've made and have read our column that we've been writing for the last 3 or 4 years. One of the things that we tend to do is we work hard to avoid political issues.
Right.
Because political issues notwithstanding, you know, most of the issues that we're talking about really are just not necessarily common sense types of things, but these are issues that whether you're Republican or Democrat, mm-hmm. These are issues that you deal with. Depression, right. anxiety, these mm-hmm. things. When it comes to guns, and this is why we're having to get into this a little bit, when it comes to guns, that has become so politicized that you really can't talk about it without mm-hmm. at least tiptoeing a mm-hmm. little bit into the political arena.
Right.
We're going to try to avoid that because, you know, I own guns, grew up with guns,
right.
you grew up with guns, everyone in my family hunts, you know, so we're not against guns.
Right.
But I think that it's illogical to work from a position to suggest that, well, the current system that we have is the only system that we need. Mm-hmm. We don't need any more relegation or regulation.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need any more rules or guidelines for how we need to handle guns, because we know with this most recent shooting, this was a person in previous shootings, people with severe mental illness who purchased guns legally,
right?
Got access to guns legally,
right?
And then had made these, you know, did these horrible things.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's naive to think that the only way that we can address this is to take away everybody's guns. I don't think that is or will ever happen. But at the same time, we can't ignore it and say, well, you know, I don't want any regulations at all. We need to just, you know, we need to keep the system the way that it is because it's more important that me as a healthy mentally healthy person, it's more important that I am able to get the guns that I want to get,
right.
And not think about any guidelines for making sure that everybody who gets guns
mm-hmm.
or has access to these kinds of weapons have similar stability.
Right.
So we have to have a good discussion about this, and not necessarily here during this podcast, but you know it's just unbelievable. To me, how some people tend to have the perspective, it's just myopic,
mm-hmm.
the perspective that, no, my Second Amendment says that I have the right to bear arms.
Right.
And that's that.
Yeah, I think it's this whole gun issue, and we bring it up within the context of mental illness.
Right.
Because every time there's a shooting, the issue of mental illness arises, even though most people with mental illness are not shooters,
mm-hmm.
Don't kill people. There's an inevitable link between these two, and it happens every time there's a shooting. You know, what was the underlying mental illness that drove this person to commit this horrendous act? All we're saying is let's at least have the discussion. Now, right. with any, whether we're talking about gay marriage, abortion, these politicized issues, one that's coming up now, just was resolved in California, is the right to die, the right to commit suicide. Those are highly politicized issues. That's not the problem. We don't want to get into that argument. But with every politicized issue, you have two extremes.
Mm-hmm.
You have those two extremes. We're not going to get rid of guns. You know, there's a far extreme that says, let's get rid of guns. You're not going to get rid of guns.
Right.
I'm sorry, you can't do it. It's just not practical. And on the other extreme, you say everybody should be armed and we should have people walking around with weapons
right.
on their hip. You know, the University of Texas this past week just made it legal that you can carry guns on campus.
Yeah.
Okay, so now you have students who are armed, and students and faculty, and I suppose workers, who are allowed legally to walk around campus with guns on. So you have the two extremes. What we're saying is we don't know enough about this issue to come up with a sensible solution. We don't have the solution. All we're suggesting is it's time to have a good analysis of the relationship, of this issue of guns and regulation and mental illness. Let's at least have a reasonable discussion.
Right.
And I think that we can find enough people between these two extremes to have a reasonable discussion so we gain some understanding so that we begin to solve this problem. We can't just keep wringing our hands and saying, oh, what was that? What do we do about this? And everybody voice an opinion. And then we go on to the next catastrophe.
Right.
And there will be another catastrophe,
right.
clearly. But let's at least have the discussion. I was absolutely flabbergasted to learn this week that the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, is prohibited by Congress from studying this gun issue.
Right.
Not that they're just not funded. They're prohibited by law from studying it because guns are not a disease. So therefore, the CDC is not allowed to study it. Why are we shutting those discussions down? We should be opening them up
right.
and take these people. These are world-class epidemiologists at CDC who could contribute to the discussion and the solution, but they're not even allowed to discuss it.
Right, and it takes us back from a couple of years ago when there was this huge discussion here in the state of Florida about yeah. the issue of pediatricians
right. exactly.
asking about, are there any guns in the house?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and people say that, well, if they're asking if there's guns in the house, that's just another way that the government is trying to monitor who has guns and all this kind of stuff. You know, it's much like, you know, I remember our pediatrician asking us if we had locks on our cabinets where we kept the bleach and the poisons.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a safety issue.
Right.
You know, and of course it passed here in the state of Florida where pediatricians are no longer allowed to ask
right.
if you have guns in the house, even though accidental shootings is one of the major causes of death right. in children.
And also, a pediatrician is in a position to know if somebody in the house does have a mental illness. What if the pediatrician knows that an older child has a mental illness?
Mm-hmm.
It would be important to know that there's a child with mental illness and there are guns in the house.
Right.
And that the child with mental illness has access to guns. That would be important information to know. But they're not allowed to ask that question.
Right. And it's not for the pediatrician to call the government
no.
and say, hey, look mm-hmm. at this, what this family is doing. It's to be able to sit down with the parents and say, hey, you mm-hmm. know, this is a serious situation.
Right.
You know, this child has these signs. You know, you should seek treatment for that because
right.
we know that that condition
mm-hmm.
mixed with these with weapons these,
right, right.
can lead to these problems.
Yeah, so all the pediatrician says is make absolutely certain that this person does not have access.
Right.
Either they're locked up or they're not loaded or something. But make sure that these two things don't get together. That's reasonable health care.
Right.
Not allowed to do it.
And we're not allowed to do it. So, and again, I think that the reason that we're so defensive about that is because it's been so politicized.
That's right.
You know, and again, not leaning left or right, but it's, you know, the Republicans want us to keep guns. the Democrats want to take guns away. And that's the way that it's seen. And like you said, Richard, perfectly, you know, it's not realistic to believe that we're going to be in a situation where nobody in the United States has a gun.
It's too big
of a country.
Right.
It's part of our culture. It's just not going to go away.
In countries like Japan, firearms have never been a part of their... Samurai swords have been a part of their culture.
Right.
They're passed down from generation to generation. Okay, but guns aren't a part of their culture. So it's not hard to get rid of guns in Japan. But in our country, guns have been a part of our culture since the very beginning.
Right.
And they're going to continue to be a part of our culture.
Right. They're not going anywhere.
Right.
So let's not... We need to back off and not have the fear of talking about this issue, specifically as it relates to people with mental illness and how they have access, how they are able to get their hands on weapons that cause damage.
Okay.
You know, I remember when I was in graduate school, one of my professors said there's not a sick line at McDonald's. And what he's saying is that, you know, we act like people who are sick are sort of sequestered from us and, you know, we never interact with them. You know, anytime you go to Walmart, you're going to be around people with mental illness. You're going to be around people. Well, I didn't mean to use Walmart specifically.
Let's back up a little.
Any store that you go to, any
mall, store you go to,
any movie theater, any place you go to, there are people with mental illness there.
That's right.
And to assume that we live separate lives from those who are mentally ill is naive at best.
You go to a lot of movies.
I do.
How many seats are in a movie theater?
Hundreds, depending on the ones you go to, yeah.
Say 100 seats.
Mm-hmm.
It means there are 20 people in there with mental illness.
Right.
Okay. Football stadium holds 90,000.
Right.
There's 18,000 people in there who are mentally ill.
Yeah.
Statistically.
Statistically.
Okay? And you're right. There is no section for the mentally ill.
Right.
They don't sit in a separate section. Okay?
Right.
They're just mingling all about there. You know, 50,000 students on a campus, 10,000 have mental illness.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we need to accept this fact.
Right.
And then open up to have the discussions that we need to have.
Mm-hmm.
Now, before we run out of any time or anything, let's shift and now talk about the second issue. Richard, what is the primary adult mental health facility in the United States?
That's right. It's the Los Angeles County Jail.
The Los Angeles County Jail. Throughout the United States, the primary provider of mental health services, inpatient mental health services, is the prison and jail system.
Prison system, right.
In childhood...
That's right.
The leading inpatient, quote-unquote inpatient, well, we could call it intensive outpatient, mental health provider is the schools.
Is the school system. The children who are mentally ill don't go. There are no mental health facilities for children who are with mental illness.
Right.
And so every day these children, and there are 10 million of them, there are 50 million school children, K-12 in the United States, and 20% of those 50 million meet diagnostic criteria for mental illness. They go to school every day.
Right.
There's no place else to send them, so they go to school every day.
Right.
At least until they're 16 or 18.
Right. So schools is another area that we have to raise awareness and we have to talk about.
That's where they are. That's where children with mental illness are concentrated, in our schools.
I remember when we, Richard, for those of you who don't know, Richard and I met working in the school system.
Mm-hmm.
Richard was actually my supervisor, my postdoctoral intern supervisor.
Right.
Actually, pre-doctoral.
Pre-doctoral.
Pre-doctoral supervisor. Mm-hmm. And I remember one of the very first things, Richard, that you told me, because I admired your history, and that's why I wanted to work with you so much, is that, you know, you had the similar history to me, that you worked in medical schools.
We
worked in the neonatal programs. We worked in pediatrics and psychiatry and neurology.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I wanted to continue my training with you. And one of the first things you said to me is that you will never have a more clinically diverse population of patients than you do working in the school system.
Right. Yeah, I had worked in hospitals. Prior to that, I had worked in hospitals and medical schools. And, you know, that's all we worked with. But it was kids with epilepsy or kids with muscular dystrophy or kids with cancer. You go into a public school and you have a complete array. It's the richest clinical population I've ever worked with is what exists in a public school. I didn't realize it at the time, but as soon as I went in there, I said, my gosh, this is where kids are who are mentally ill. Kids with mental illness are in school.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yet, as we were working in the schools, our hands are tied. There are so many things that you can't do to provide mental health treatment to children in schools. Mm-hmm. You're stuck to this behavioral perspective where everything is reward-punish. We're using positive behavior support. We're using behavioral therapy. We're using these mechanisms that seek to change behavior but don't really get at the root cause of a lot of these behaviors. And so it perpetuates problems that could be addressed if you were allowed to do real mental health treatment in the schools.
Right. Yeah, so that while we have all these kids with true psychiatric disorders in our schools, schools tend to see any what they would call abnormal behavior or emotions as a behavior problem.
Right.
They don't see it as a mental health problem. They see it as a behavior problem. And they treat it as a behavior problem. Every school has a code of conduct. Every school district has a code of conduct. And the code of conduct is, if you perform this behavior, you're going to get this consequence.
Right. Okay?
Well, some of these kids are not able to control their behavior because of their mental illness, and yet they're treated as though they are.
Right.
And so if we're going to admit children with mental illness to our schools, then I argue that we have the obligation to consider the mental illness as part of their schooling.
Right.
That we're not doing.
Right. And the other piece to that is teacher education.
Exactly.
You know, teachers do not, for the most part, get much training at all in how to manage emotional and behavioral difficulties. Mm-hmm. A lot of the teachers that I worked with had maybe one class.
One course, that's right.
In behavioral management. And that really, my impression from them is it was sort of the extent of this is how you set up a set of classroom rules.
Right. I mean, how much can you do in 15 weeks?
Right.
How much can you learn?
So teachers don't get a lot of training in how to manage ADHD.
Right.
You know, a disorder that affects 9 to 10% of school-age children.
Right.
They don't get much information on autism. They don't get much information on these mental health issues that are prevalent and increasing in prevalence.
Right. And there was a time when these kids in the 70s, 80s, 90s, where kids with special needs were taken out of regular classrooms. That has changed now. The system is called inclusion. And now kids with mental illness are being put back into the regular classroom. And the regular classroom teacher is expected to manage those kids. Well, if you're if you're trained in a typical teacher training program at a university, you're going to get one course in how to manage kids with mental illness. It simply isn't enough training to do so effectively. Okay.
Right.
And so that's what we're facing. We have now put all these children back into the regular classroom, and the teacher has to somehow make sense of that.
Right.
They simply can't do it because they don't have the training.
Right. And you know, I remember again when we worked in the schools, we were often asked to go in and help teachers deal with some of these things and help them manage some of these behaviors. And, you know, it was helpful for the teachers, but you know, you can only do so much when you're working one person at a time.
That's right.
We need a system in place where teachers can get the training that they need, where we can have in-service training so that they understand what's going on and that they have the support that they need. You know, unfortunately, you know, the era of the school psychologist is almost gone.
It's The idea of having trained psychologists in schools is diminishing. In our county, school psychologists are now spread to cover several schools. And right. So they're not even in the same building every day. They might be at a different school every day.
Right.
So if a child needs services on a Tuesday, they won't get them until the next if the school psychologist is only there on Tuesday, that's what they have to wait for Tuesday. So right. Not only are the teachers not trained, but they're not given adequate resources to help them deal with these kids.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. So,
and that's getting worse because,
yeah.
Well, we'll deal with that another time.
Yeah. So we have to keep working on that. And I know where you were going because, and I'm going to say it anyways, is that the primary, the other component of that, it's not necessarily the primary, but the other component about that is that we are creating a climate in the schools that's exacerbating mental health problems.
It is.
We are creating a situation. I was listening to I must listen to too many podcasts, but I was listening to a podcast the other day.
I probably wouldn't disagree.
And they're saying that, you know, I hear people talking about why are we concerned about giving, you know, putting stress on kids. That's silly. That's preparing them for adulthood. That's
for
preparing them for real life.
Yeah.
That's an unbelievable perspective. Mm-hmm. It's a sad perspective to me. Mm-hmm. You know, I met a kid for the first time this week who, you know, he was retained in third grade. You know, he's struggling. He has so many issues going on at home with his biological parents and who, you know, he tells me at this time are incarcerated. He's living right. with extended family members. Mm-hmm. And all this stuff is going on. And then he goes to school and has to take a test.
Right.
And he fails the test. And so he's going to be in third grade again. And now they're wondering why he has behavioral problems, why he's angry, why he, you know, he doesn't care, he's given up. It's amazing to me that these otherwise intelligent people can't put these pieces together. Mm-hmm. You know, found out this week or talked to somebody this week about how in high school, we have students who are having to learn in books that are written, you know, two or three grade levels ahead, despite the fact that the students themselves may have a learning disability, may have mm-hmm. Intellectual deficits, may be English language learners.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They're having to study from a book that's written several grade levels ahead.
Right.
And then they're going to take a test at the end of the year that's written at the college level.
Right.
And then we wonder why these kids are discouraged, why they're stressed, why they're depressed, why they drop out. These are otherwise intelligent adults
mm-hmm.
that for some reason, maybe like what we were talking about with the gun situation, they become so myopic and they, mm-hmm. they put these blinders on that
right.
they don't really see what's going on and what's happening.
You know, if you're a policymaker and you're listening to this, or if you're listening to this and you have access to a policymaker, please try to understand that about 80% of school children can handle whatever we throw at them. It doesn't matter what book you use, doesn't matter who the teacher is. Kids have got, millions of children have gone through schools with different kinds of curriculum, different kinds of textbooks, different kinds of teachers, and they've done just fine. So stress for that 80% is not, you're right, it isn't a big issue. What we're talking about now, that there are at least 20% of children who can't handle it. They mm-hmm. cannot, it's not their fault, they cannot handle it. For whatever reason, for a variety of reasons, they can't handle it. And what we've done is we have forgotten that 20% exists. And the what are called educational reforms are really aimed at the 80%.
Right.
And 20% are being neglected, and 20% are struggling, and 20% are suffering. Not only are the kids suffering, their teachers are suffering, and their families are suffering. And somebody has got to acknowledge that whatever we're doing in schools isn't working for 20% of the children. That's a significant percentage. That's 1 out of 5.
Right.
Okay.
That's our. That's that should be our next book. Teaching the 20%.
Teaching 20%. We used to. We at one time we did acknowledge that 20%. Today we're not. We put them in regular classrooms and we expect them to be able to read and write and do math at grade level. And right. if they can't, then some teacher gets blamed for that. It's not fair to the kids. Not fair to the teachers.
Right. Right. Now, before we run out of time, let's go to the last area that we want to talk about because, well, again, just like with guns, we could talk about schools for days.
Right.
And that is, I posted on Twitter and Facebook last night this Wall Street Journal column written by U.S. Representative Tim Murphy from Pennsylvania. He's proposing this, or he has written this new act called the Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis Act.
Right.
Now, I'm mentioning it. I've read this article and I found it last night, and I haven't had a chance to really get in and look at the act and see everything that he's written. But at least in this column that's written, he says a lot of really good things. And I think that the first thing that we need to that I want to mention is that, unlike most of his fellow representatives, Mr. Murphy is a, and they refer to him as Mr. Murphy in this column, his shirt tail says Mr. Murphy, but he's a psychologist.
Mm-hmm.
He's a psychology in the Navy Reserves. Unlike many of his representative colleagues, he's not an attorney. And, you know, I think one of the things that it's important for people to think about is that attorneys are sort of trained to take a side.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, unlike physicians and unlike psychologists and unlike people from other areas, professional areas, attorneys do a really good job because it's what they have to do is that they have to take a side and develop a case for their perspective, whether it's their prospective clients or the company that they're representing. And so Mr. Murphy or Dr. Murphy, I'm not sure which one, you know, he's talking about this Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis Act. One of the things that he says in this article, which I think has to be mentioned, is that we think about people with mental illness receiving treatment, but we often forget that their caregivers
right.
are the day in and day out treatment providers.
Right.
You know, whether we're talking about a child with mental illness and the parent who has to take care of them and deal with the
right.
pick up the pieces every day that they have to provide the treatment and the medication and take them to
therapies.
And from therapies mm-hmm. and everything. Or we're talking about the adult whose parent is suffering from Alzheimer's
mm-hmm.
and they're having to, you know, make decisions regarding end-of-life decisions and make decisions regarding hospice care or
right.
make decisions regarding treatment for
mm-hmm.
their loved one with mental with dementia. We need to find a way to support these caregivers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We know that a lot of these caregivers end up developing depression and anxiety, and you know it leads to horrible things like regret and things that just affect
right.
other relationships and affect their overall life functioning. You know,
right.
how many people have we met who quit their job so that they can stay home and take care of their child or stay home and take care of their elderly parent? It happens all the time, but yet this is a huge group of people that's only
right.
going to continue to grow with the aging
right.
baby boomers.
Right.
It's going to continue to grow, but it's an entire population of people that's completely ignored.
That's right. Whether we're talking about parents who are providing services for their children, spouses who are providing services for their partners, or parents who are providing services for their elderly parents, that sandwich generation, they're all telling us the same story, that it completely, taking care of a person with mental illness changes everything about your life, financial, social, everything. And yet they tell us the same thing. There is no support for the caregivers. In fact, the caregivers are being blocked from providing efficient and effective care by, again, regulations that had good intentions when they were written. I'm thinking about HIPAA right now.
Right, right.
There's good intention there to protect one's privacy, but if you're taking care of a spouse who's mentally ill, you need to help their physicians and psychologists make decisions. They're really not able to make decisions for themselves, and yet I, as a spouse, can't get access to my spouse's records because of HIPAA.
Right. Yeah. Imagine being married and your spouse has bipolar disorder.
Right.
And your spouse goes to treatment because you're encouraging it and they're going. But they start experiencing a manic episode and you call the physician to try to get some support.
Right.
And the physician tells you, I can't talk to you about it.
Not allowed. Legally not allowed to talk to you. You're the care provider, but they're not allowed to talk to you.
So, again, reform is needed.
Right.
Sensible reform is needed.
Right.
Not to make this a Republican or a Democrat thing.
It's not a political issue.
It's not that. It's a realistic, real life. These are real problems that we have to find a way to address.
That's right.
And we need people who can sit down and talk about these things in an adult and reasonable fashion so that we can address them and make improvements and make people's lives better.
Yeah, one of the saddest stories that I heard was it was a spouse, and the spouse with mental illness didn't want her partner to come to the doctor, to the visits with her psychiatrist. And so he wasn't allowed in the room. So he had no idea what his spouse was telling her psychiatrist.
Right.
So, but he is responsible for managing her care. And yet he didn't know anything about what they had discussed, what medications she was supposed to be taking. And when he would call, the psychiatrist would apologize, but I'm sorry, I can't. That's privileged information.
Right. So again, whether it's the gun issue, whether it's the school issue, whether it's caregivers, we have to address head on this issue of the mental illness stigma.
Right.
We have to accept that this is a major health related problem here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And
this is a health crisis.
It really is a health crisis.
Right.
And we have to do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
I know we've been talking about a lot of ideas.
Right.
We hopefully have some new things that we're going to be announcing in the coming weeks about what we're trying to do here to help with some of that.
What our contribution will be to.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because we feel like, obviously, this is something that we're very passionate about,
and we would like to volunteer for that. Let's have that discussion. Let's somehow start this discussion about what to do about this problem.
Right.
And again, if you're a policymaker or you have access to a policymaker, let us know what we can do. We want to be part of the discussion. We want to be part of the debate. We want to be part of the solution. So please let us know.
Right. Right. All right, it's about time to wrap up. So we would love to hear your thoughts.
Yes,
what do you think about this? So please write to us. You can do that on Facebook. You can do that on Twitter. You can do that on our blog. You can do that we're on Instagram. We're on Pinterest. We have things all over the place.
We're everywhere.
There's lots of ways to reach out to us. So please get in touch with us. Let us know what you think. Let us know your thoughts about these issues and. We're always interested in hearing more possible solutions for some of these problems and talking about it and getting the information out there. We also really encourage you, if you have the opportunity, to jump onto iTunes and write a review for us, just to get it increases our visibility so other people can know that we're here, that they can see us, and that they may join in the discussion. And again, if you're not listening to us live now, check us out on Mixlr, mixlr.com. It's a great way to be able to listen live and interact with us while we're doing the podcast every Friday morning. All right, is that everything?
I think that's everything. Not everything, but it's a start.
It's a start.
Right.
So, with that said, I'm Dr. Bernie.
And I'm Dr. Richard.
And we look forward to talking with you next week. Have a great week.
I'm looking forward to it. I'd like to talk about this again.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to The Mental Breakdown. If you want more information, you can check out our website at www.pacflorida.com. The Mental Breakdown is sponsored in part by theledger.com, where you can read our weekly column in the Live section. Our podcasts are available for download on iTunes, and you can follow us on our YouTube channel and Facebook. We would love to hear from you, so feel free to send us messages either through our website or on Facebook. You can send us questions or topics you would like for us to address on future podcasts. Drs. Bernie and Richard are available for workshops, so you can contact us for more information. Thank you for listening, and until next time, stay mentally healthy.